So good evening again. Thank you again for inviting me. This is such a wonderful group of people. You have such lovely activities going on, and it's great to be here. So tonight's talk topic will revolve in the arena of loving kindness, compassion, and the big mind perspective. So we'll see what I can do for that, those three, to kind of weave them together in a little bit of review. My job, as I see it, in this kind of context and in the sitting groups in Tacoma, is a little bit of a cheerleader to kind of cheer you on or offer inspiration and offer inspiration so that you might remember again and again how really precious this path is and how fortunate we all are to have the teachings and have the opportunity. And we need to hear that again and again, because sometimes it's a bit of a struggle on the cushion, a struggle getting to the sittings or sitting at home, or occasionally just the sense of, I don't quite understand why I'm observing my breath. What is this about and what is this for? So at least that's how I've felt for many, many years, that when I was learning, that I really went to the sittings where there were teachers and a group to sit with to kind of cheer myself along, be a little cheerleader for myself, because there's very few places where one can be in company of others walking the same path, struggling the same struggle. As one person, 1 3-month retreat years ago, put on the bulletin board at IMS, suffering in silence together. So it's nice to have these opportunities to join with others and then to hear some sharing, also to hear different voices. I know you do that in SIMS, invite a whole range of teachers, and I think that's a wonderful thing. I like to recommend a lot of different books for the people that I work with so that you can hear different voices, different perspectives, different techniques. As I have often said, that this is a precious path. It's a golden path, really. It's definitely the yellow brick road. The opportunities and the confluence of events and situations that have to come together for us to be on the path are pretty extraordinary when we think about it. And in fact, that's one of the traditional reflections in the Buddhist tradition, is precious human birth, free and well-favored. And what it means is that you have the health, the opportunity, the financial situation so that you would have time to practice, also the interest. All of those things comprise free and well-favored. There are so many people who would love to have the opportunity to practice, but they don't have the time, they don't have the resources. They live in a country where they can't have teachers except maybe covertly. So many, many different things can arise to block the opportunity to practice. So it is so precious that we have this opportunity, that we have that choice, that we can make that choice, that we can suffer in silence together. So I do want to encourage you. There are various beautiful images for the path of Dharma, for the path of the Buddhist teaching. And one that I love, and I know many of you love, is the bird. the two wings of the Dharma. And one wing is wisdom, and one wing is compassion. And so if you need just a short image to remember what the path is about, it's about cultivating wisdom and cultivating compassion. And in equal measure, you've never seen a bird flying with one wing, or even they don't make birds with one long wing and one short wing. You know, that it doesn't work. So that the cultivation of wisdom and the strength of wisdom on our path of practice needs to be equally strong, and the cultivation of compassion needs to be equally strong. So we cultivate them both in equal measure. There are many, many teachings in all the different traditions on these, the cultivation of these two wings of the Dharma. I have a lot of background in Theravada tradition, but I also have some measure of background in Soto Zen, and last 13 years, some significant practice in the Dzogchen tradition of Tibetan Buddhism. But in the heart of all of the teachings, you know, they come from the same teacher. So there is this path of practice that strengthens wisdom and compassion. So in the wisdom wing, of course, we have various mindfulness practices, we have various teaching, and we have various study. Varieties and varieties of techniques to cultivate, to strengthen wisdom. The wisdom that sees into the true nature of reality itself, wisdom that sees into our true experience, what's really going on here, seeing into suffering, the teachings on suffering, what gives rise to suffering, the possibility of letting go of suffering, and the path to accomplishing that possibility of letting go of suffering, the teachings on seeing into the three essential characteristics of all conditioned existence, the characteristic of anicca, endless change, impermanence, dukkha, what was for most of the years of translations into English of the Buddhist tradition, suffering, the suffering nature of existence. But sometimes some more modern translations, Ajahn Chah Sarro translates that as stress, which makes it clear for a lot of people who might otherwise are in the fortunate layer, the fortunate tiny layer of humanity who don't experience their life as much suffering. But they, when you say the word stress, then they, oh, okay, I know what dukkha is now. I know what that is. Teachings on dukkha. And anatta, the absence of a solid eternal self, the nature of emptiness, interbeingness of reality itself. So all those, the teachings, the study, and particularly the practices of cultivating wisdom, the wisdom wing. And then on the compassion wing of the Dharma, the practices of training in, specifically in loving kindness and compassion, again, in the traditions, variety of techniques. I particularly love the Burmese style of the Brahmavihara practices. And Sharon Salzberg and Joseph Goldstein were my primary teachers in intensive loving kindness practices, compassion practices at IMS, but I've had a lot of other opportunities. I also, in 2001, spent 2 months up at Gampo Abbey, where you can now ordain temporarily. So I was ordained as a Tibetan Buddhist nun for a couple of months with Pema Chodron, which was quite wonderful. And Pema Chodron, as many of you know, has given us wonderful, wonderful books on the teachings of loving kindness and then compassion, and particularly the Tonglen practices from the Tibetan tradition. So we see a wide range of teachings and practices on cultivating compassion, loving kindness, a generous heart, and also a balanced heart in these traditions. It's wonderfully rich. The key is, of course, that whatever we read and study and even sit up here and talk about, we have to practice. We really, that's the main point. That's the pith instruction. We do have to go home and practice, sitting in practice or practice in daily life practice. And there are many ways that we can augment the sitting practices that we do in both the cultivation of wisdom and in the cultivation of compassion, with many opportunities in our daily life. It's possible that our modern lives give us many more opportunities to cultivate compassion. Certainly than many people of previous centuries, just because I feel like on any given day, if you're walking in a downtown city, you might on one day meet more people than, say, my farming ancestors of a couple centuries ago met in an entire year, possibly. So in that respect, our lives, we cross the paths of so many other beings so often, certainly much more than anyone who was on long retreat in a cave or in the Thai forest, that we have many, many opportunities to challenge ourselves and to practice compassion, loving kindness, and so forth. So we can see that, you know, we have sometimes are frustrated about the speed of modern life, the density of modern life, but we can see it as an opportunity for particular kinds of training because we're in the mix. We're right in the mix with those sorts of things. And that would be a very, we'd say, Buddhist way to look at it, because at a certain point for this path of practice, one begins to take on the sort of this assignment and the understanding that actually everything is a teaching and every situation is an opportunity to cultivate wisdom and compassion. And then every moment that we have missed an opportunity, the next moment is an opportunity to cultivate forgiveness and then to cultivate wisdom and compassion and to, again, cultivate gratitude. So these wonderful moment by moment by moment, our lives just arise for us as these opportunities. We tend to look too much at the past with maybe strong regret or strong remorse or guilt or shame or blame. In the traditions, they say that really it's not really particularly useful or helpful to spend much time in guilt, shame, blame. Some regret and some remorse can be skillful if it just helps us correct course. But in any of you who've done any kind of canoeing or whitewater rafting, something where you're cruising along at a very rapid speed and rapids and boulders and things are coming at you very quickly, that's kind of the image, or I suppose some video games might be similar in the fact the image of our lives move at that pace. So if you're, you know, say you're in a boat whitewater rafting with five or six of your friends, you don't want anybody in the boat to be spending a lot of time discussing with regret or remorse about the mistake they made two rapids ago as you're heading into, you know, some class fives on the river. You just, you know, it's not useful at that moment. But, you know, if we can learn, it's useful. You know, you can yell out, maybe when the water's a little bit still or you catch an eddy, you can say, say, what would have been a better thing for me to do than what I just did in that last rapid? And somebody can tell you, and that's it. Then you have to let it go because it's coming at you. The next moment of our lives, the next opportunity is coming. So we can learn from this a sense of release and relaxing and letting go. We can have a little regret, a little remorse. If it helps us cultivate a course correction, maybe make more wholesome choices, maybe, you know, no emotion, oh, that wasn't wise. Particularly from the point of view in the tradition, it would be rather than right, wrong, good, bad, supposed to, not supposed to, what are the rules? The point we'd want to look at would be, did it create suffering for me or for other people? Or we would say wholesome behavior would be behavior that does not create suffering. And even better, maybe create some happiness for ourselves and for other people. Or happiness for ourselves without costing other people their happiness. So looking at things with that kind of attitude and then letting go. And the forgiveness practice is really wonderful. I had a student a while ago mentioning that some particularly painful and difficult time had happened about 10 years before. And this person said that they thought that they'd done a lot of forgiveness work at that time with that event. But clearly it was coming up again. And I would say that's just the nature of our experience, that it's a bit, again, like dredging. So that certainly the forgiveness work that we've done at whatever time is wonderful work. It doesn't mean that it, quote unquote, didn't work. If decade down the road, some of that same, the memory and the upset, maybe the anger, the disappointment, the grief arises once again, particularly if we're doing some sort of spiritual practice, because we are sort of intentionally dredging when we're doing spiritual practice. So then again, we can do our forgiveness practice. Or we might just, as I did this evening, have just a small forgiveness phrase that we do at the beginning, at the ending of every meditation, of every day, just to lighten the load a bit. It's a bit, you remember the old days when you erased the chalkboard? I always think of that. And particularly, it's so funny that, you know, it was one of a discipline thing sometimes in my generation where students would have to, if they misbehaved, would have to stay after and clean the chalkboards. But I love that notion of that kind of cleansing for the day. Okay, now we're done. Now we're done. Forgiveness of ourselves, forgiveness for others, and then the cultivation of loving kindness. It's just, it keeps you up. We're not so carrying, dragging the past along behind us quite so much. If we just get in the habit of updating the brief forgiveness reflection, forgiveness contemplation. In the traditions, in the teachings, they often speak of the absolute level of understanding, the teachings, and then the relative level. We're hanging out mostly on the relative level. But sometimes we get insights into, get closer to the absolute level, which is a wonderful thing. But sometimes that also gets us a little bit confused because, for example, when we train in the loving kindness practice and the loving kindness verses, we mention very specific beings, ourselves and other people. And if you've looked into the writings on it, there are lists of different beings, creatures, individuals, all those in existence, males, females, enlightened beings, unenlightened beings, devas. It goes on and on that we train in loving kindness. But then the question can come up, well, if really there are no separate beings, if really as our realization grows, we understand interbeingness and that there is no separation and that we're all really a part of one vast ocean and we're just under the illusion that we're kind of separate little droplets, not connected with any of the other drops in the ocean, then why do we have to train in sending loving kindness to all beings? And questions like that come up in the other teachings as well. And Buddhism is nothing else if it isn't very, very practical. And we might even say, in our modern words, scientific, phenomenological, those kinds of words. It says, let's look at how things actually are for us. Yes, there are these higher insights into the true nature of interbeing and interconnectedness and so forth. But then there's our daily lives. And until we really reach some very, very high levels, Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, saints and sages, on those levels, until we're really there, a lot of our life is spent in the relative and the ordinary. So it's very useful and very skillful to learn some techniques and practices that will zero right in to what our actual experience is. And that's what I love about particularly the loving kindness practices, the compassion practices that help us train specifically. It's like when you go to the gym, you know, the coach can, some of you might be coaches at gyms, might train specific muscle groups or show you which ones to use. There are different ones if you want to run a triathlon or if you just want to be able to pick up your grandchild. You know, there'll be different muscle groups that you'll be strengthening and training in different ways. So that's also the case that in the traditions, there are actually very specific ways to train. If we experience more envy, say, if that's an issue for us, or if there's a sense of a lot of selfishness, self-centeredness, or if we have too much of just giving away ourselves till we're so exhausted we possibly can't stand, that might be the loving kindness practices toward ourselves more than others. So there are very specific ways and teachings about it, and it has to do with being practical and realizing that until everything in our experience, every moment is on the absolute level, then we need to train in practical ways on the relative level. There also, we're very fortunate that we have so many teachers and so many teachings now. It can be a little bit confusing, but it's also just amazing. If you think of, you know, just maybe a century ago, first, there you'd have to be in a Buddhist country to receive these teachings. Maybe a century and a half ago. I'm thinking before any airplanes. And then, if you lived in one gulch, one mountain valley, one forest, there might be a teacher in your area that you could walk a few days or if you were really fortunate in town. But that would be it. And those techniques, whoever that teacher was, you'd have, you know, those were pretty much the ones that you would learn. Be fortunate if those were ones that fit with you. Not so fortunate if they didn't quite fit your personality type. But here we have such a wide range. We have teachers available. Although, again, you have to count yourself lucky because in the correspondence course, a lot of people who take the correspondence course take it because there isn't anybody within a couple hours driving that they can, you know, in the hinterlands of not only this country, but I have students in other countries as well. Or like on Guam, you know, I had a couple students from Guam. So to be fortunate that you live in such proximity to a lot of different teachers and resources. And then also the books, I just, again, we're very, very lucky. We can even go to used bookstores, buy books for so little money that a century ago you would have had to cross half the earth, climb several mountains, and learn two or three languages in order to get those teachings. So again, we're fortunate in that way. So we can work, we can practice, we can find the people that we relate to as teachers or spiritual friends, just coaches, like I'm kind of just a coach. And then we connect with a kind of a sense of inner teacher or inner coach. That'd be good. The inner coach. The sense of commitment to proceeding along this path and showing up for the practice, for our own personal study, and to continually proceed. When we fall off the cushion, so to speak, to get back on again, however many times. There's a wonderful Zen teaching I just love. Zen is pithy, just short things that could be several pages long. So this one is falling down 53 times, getting up 54 times, which is pretty much how it happens, both with our practice in general, and then also even when we get distracted, coming back and coming back and coming back. Think of, an 18-month-old learning to walk. They don't care how many times they plop down because they're interested in getting up until they walk. So that kind of attitude and that sense of commitment and taking responsibility ourselves for the journey, getting coaching and so forth, but also that feeling of responsibility. Some people, there's a word in a lot of the traditions of devotion, and some people just resonate with that right away, but many people it's like, devotion, that was what I ran from in my childhood and so forth. But, another, for people with that sort of temperament, another angle on devotion is responsibility. So that we take responsibility in a joyful way, a kind of a joyful responsibility for our path and our journey, and a little bit of a kind of a positive self-esteem, not a pridefulness that's negative, but kind of in a positive way that we have taken on this challenge and we intend to proceed. We fall off 53 times, we're just going to get back on 54 times. That's not an issue. That's just the way things are for everybody. But that real sense of commitment, responsibility, devotion to the journey, whatever feels right, whatever the flavor is right for you, to stay with it. Wisdom and compassion. Another way I would say it, maybe to have three categories, would be our work toward enlightened awareness or primordial awareness, or maybe that's the wisdom teachings. And then loving kindness from where we are now, cultivating loving kindness to the saints and sages level of immeasurable loving kindness. And then compassion. So I kind of break it into three a little bit sometimes. So you can kind of check off periodically, every 3 or 6 months or so, asking, how am I doing? Wisdom, primordial awareness, cultivating any direction in that, in our small ways, how we do it. Loving kindness, compassion. Am I stretching my heart? Just little by little, is it happening for me? And then we can say, okay, all right, I'm proceeding on the path. One arena of the wisdom practices, the awareness practices, are techniques that kind of fall under a title of a big mind perspective. So we get this phrase that some of it shows up in Zen, shows up in other traditions too, certainly. Maybe more the sense of the luminous vastness, cultivating an awareness of the luminous vastness. I like that one a lot, particularly in these long, sunny days when the sky is just endlessly blue. There's that feeling of luminous vastness. So this is actually, it's a perspective, and it also can be kind of practice technique. Big mind, luminous vastness, primordial awareness. So I want to show you how to do it a little bit. First of all, as I said, if you remember just one word, relax. Ajahn Mun, the great Thai forest master of late 19th, early 20th century, one of my heroes. Ajahn Mun said, Nibbana, he said it with Pali. He said it in Pali. I don't know what he said it in. Anyway, Thai. Nibbana is the ultimate ease. Nirvana is the ultimate ease. E-A-S-E. So relax. And then let go. That's another, I think, Ajahn Sumedho used to talk about that a lot. Let go, let go, let go. If you let go a little, you'll have a little peace. If you let go a lot, you'll have a lot of peace. And if you let go completely, you will have complete peace. So it's stages. It's little by little. So relax, let go. Some examples. In our everyday experience, we see the mind narrowing around stuff. Okay? Narrowing, tightening. Relax is open, loosen, wide. So you can think about anger, for example. Think about recent something at work. Surely there was something recently where there's anger or frustration, maybe not full-blown anger, but frustration. The feeling is that we're narrowing around our position. I'm right, they're wrong. This kind, they're doing whatever they're doing, that's not the way I want it to be. So we see, you know, it's nice we have this technology because we can think of wide-angle focus lens, and then suddenly there's a narrow focus. Or, you know, you think of a movie, there's maybe a crowd scene, just people, say at a mall or at the downtown or something. And then the focus of the lens, the film and the camera zooms in, and there's somebody, a couple of people in the crowd arguing, you know, or fighting. So you feel how anger, frustration is a narrowing of the focus. So a technique can be just as we do on the cushion or chair, is relax and open wide again. And so it might be just the perspective itself. We might not feel it in the body so much, or we may, but we might just have the perspective of, one of the big mind perspectives is this going to matter in 3 months? Is this going to matter next week? And in 3 years, am I even going to remember this? So that's a nice little big mind technique. Just that reminder that, you know, again, the rapids are moving along, the raft, we're going along. It's not worth it. It's really not worth it. So, and then physically, and many people, maybe that's how they feel it more than with the analysis, that sense of anger, frustration, tight, the body's tight, the muscles are tight, teeth and so forth, the brows furrow. If you can just, you know, breathe and relax and open, you see the sensations of anger go way down. Then the mind has to kind of conjure it up again. Well, but they and I and blah, blah, blah. And then the tightening again. But then again, a deep breath and a relaxing. And you feel the awareness expand its focus so that we're opening to a sense of big mind, luminous vastness, open awareness. Or desire, again, desire is a narrowing, real desire. You know, I want that and I want it now and I want to do whatever I need to do to get it and I'm not interested in hearing about anything else. That's pretty much a strong desire. So you see how that narrows again. It narrows and it focuses on me. I want that, I want it now. You can get an experience of that, you know, if you're... malls are a good example. Or anywhere where you're going in a crowded space and there's one thing that you have to get and it's, I don't know, the day after Thanksgiving or something and you have not been able to avoid it. So you're in this crush of people and stores and whatever, but you have a mission and you're just focused on, I have to get this thing and I have to get there. So it's this very narrowing. Now that might be fine, it, you know, might be a lovely thing that you're getting for a friend or something. But in the unwholesome states of desire and wanting, where it's creating suffering for ourselves or other people, particularly the people we're elbowing away through. So to relax again, the big mind perspective, once again, a good big mind perspective is, how much is this going to matter in 3 months? 3 years? Or what do the other people need? there are other people? You know? Oh, really? Because we can focus so tightly that we forget there are other people. And then again, this relaxing. With desire, it's often helpful first before you open into a physical awareness of openness, to ground yourself physically, like the base of a mountain. So, because desire is kind of falling forward, so if you get your body back and down and solid, then a sense of opening out, and then the wishing and the desire can't really knock you over. I once worked in the Transamerica Pyramid at one of the top floors, and it was great to look out and realize, yep, I don't know why more buildings aren't shaped like that in earthquake areas. Because there's no way it was going to fall over. It's just not going to happen. So that sense of, they say, sit like a mountain. Judging another, again, we get very narrow. Again, there, that, and da-da-da, judge. It narrows. And again, the big mind is to relax that, to see other people, to open one's focus wide. That sense of widening, also widening our view. It's sort of the difference between the Red Queen, you know, off with their heads. And that sense of relaxing and realizing that there are such a range of people on this planet and such a range of opinions and ways to do things. That really, how do we know what, we know they're not doing what we want them to do. But how do we know what that... So there's a sense of relaxing. There's also that relaxing can actually empower us more if we actually do need... If someone else is creating suffering for ourselves or others, to act with more strength when we have this kind of open, grounded feeling. So there's a variety of ways, and you can experiment with it a lot, to have just this big mind perspective, or even the practice itself. And you can do it on the cushion as well, of contacting an awareness that's much bigger than like the imagined size of our head. You know, like when you're meditating, you can pretend that your mind is as big as this room. Then you can think, no, the mind is as big as that whole cathedral back there. And then maybe even a sense of the mind as wide as the sky itself. That open awareness, that's the big mind perspective. Open, wide, empty yet bright, full of compassion. And then the heart practices are just so, they work. They work. They really do work. Teaching, particularly the correspondence course, where I get a lot of written feedback. I've been maybe 10 years now getting written feedback. emails and handwritten feedback, it's clear these loving kindness practices work. Just to do them step by step, they're outlined step by step. I don't know if you know. Of course, you've heard of Sharon Salzberg's book, Loving Kindness: The Revolutionary Art of Happiness. Very good, solid text for loving kindness practice. But there's a new item she has out. I call it an item because it's the new thing. It's a book with a CD sleeve in the back. So it's called The Force of Kindness, published by Sounds True. And on the CD are four guided loving kindness meditations. So this is quite wonderful because now you can just pop it on the CD player and have a guided meditation to do. So these techniques, they really do work. We have to do them. They're step-by-step trainings. The Buddha mentioned many places about the power of kindness, the power of metta. Here's one verse. All actions by which one acquires merits are not worth the 16th part of friendliness. Metta. This translator translates metta as friendliness, which is nice. Which is the emancipation of mind. For metta radiates, shines, and illumines, surpassing those actions as the emancipation of mind, just as all the lights of the stars are not worth the 16th part of moonlight. For moonlight, surpassing them all, radiates, shines, and illumines. So he mentions three times in that short verse, metta, loving kindness, radiates, shines, and illumines. It really is a light, really a light coming from the heart. The Buddha also said, abandon what is unskillful. One can abandon the unskillful. If it were not possible, I would not ask you to do it. If this abandoning of the unskillful would bring harm and suffering, I would not ask you to abandon it. But as it brings benefit and happiness, therefore I say, abandon what is unskillful. Cultivate the good. One can cultivate the good. If it were not possible, I would not ask you to do it. If this cultivation were to bring harm and suffering, I would not ask you to do it. But as this cultivation brings benefit and happiness, I say, cultivate the good. Now, with loving kindness, this Buddhist psychology and the practices and the trainings, very precise, very scientific, teachings about the proximate cause of feeling loving kindness. So there's a sense of, well, yeah, I'd love to have loving kindness for all beings or even my neighbors or particularly the difficult people, but I don't know, I don't have it. I've been wishing for it, you know, I've been praying for it, I've been hoping for it. But, you know, if I tell the truth, I don't really have it. So what do I do? Or we may find, you know, that in our heart of hearts, if we tell the truth, we don't experience a significant amount of loving kindness toward ourselves. You know, again, people say it's good to have self-esteem, but, you know, I just feel a lot of self-criticism, a lot of self-judgment and so forth. So, this is normal, painful, suffering, but normal. So, in the teachings, one of the practices has to do with cultivating the proximate cause of loving kindness. The proximate cause is the cause right next to it before it'll actually happen. Like if I have the proximate cause of you hearing this gong would be me hitting it. So the proximate cause of feeling loving kindness is seeing the goodness. in someone or in yourself. So the technique is, if you're not feeling, and this is any of you who have any moments of not feeling good about yourself, I'm giving you an assignment. Your assignment is reflecting on your good qualities. Literally, again, it's got to be literal. We're overeducated. We're really well educated, and so often we think if we understand something, we read the book, we hear the talk, we understand it. That's it. We're done. No, it's like, you know, I could understand so much about, again, whitewater rafting. I could understand the physics, water physics, and so forth. I could study it. But if I hadn't actually ever done it, there wouldn't be anything much practical. And I really couldn't say that I know about it. I could say I know about it intellectually. So we need to practice these things. So actually, when you're feeling, and it really works, I swear, when you're feeling no loving kindness for yourself, then start reflecting in a list, you could write it down, your good qualities, the good things you've done in your life. And any of you who are parents, you've just got to get out of jail free card. I've not had a child, but, you know, keeping a young being alive for the first few years of their life, the endless, you know, feeding and changing and not sleeping, being woken up at night and so forth, all of those, just each of those acts of goodness. But those of us who haven't, we have other things we can make on our list as well. So just thinking of all the small acts of goodness that we've done in our lives. And as you think of those, and of course because our minds are so the thoughts will come of, yeah, but you just dismiss those, all the critical thoughts. Just let them, they're not on the list. But listing and thinking of the acts of goodness in your life and making it a practice to do that, and then there will be the arising of a feeling of friendliness toward yourself, feeling of kindness. Some people like the word love and loving kindness. It feels good. Other people, it's not so good. So emphasizing the kindness part or friendliness. You know, the word is translated in a variety of ways. And then if there is someone in the outside world that you don't feel any loving kindness toward, if you can think of something good they've done or imagine something good, then that will be the proximate cause. And you might, it might take effort, but you make some effort and start to think about that. You know, maybe they love dogs and you love dogs. Maybe you find that out about them. Who knows? Then the proximate cause will be the arising of the feeling of loving kindness. And then, of course, we cultivate it. We do the verses, the phrases. It's a little bit like weight. It's a lot like weight training. You do a lot of reps. Spend most of your reps on the lighter weights. It's funny. It's kind of counterintuitive or something for us anyway, but loving kindness is a happiness practice. So spend the most time with your benefactor being and then toward yourself and dear friends, and only just a little bit, you know, like when you go in the gym, you don't grab that heavy weight right away. You take the lighter ones, and maybe at the end of the session, a couple reps with the heavier weight, then go back to the lighter ones again, or you'll train yourself. You don't want to be practicing struggle. You want to be practicing loving kindness. But little by little, you will get stronger and the circle will widen itself. So that's, and loving kindness training. So then, what about compassion? Compassion's a little bit different flavor. It's true that if you cultivate wisdom, your compassion will grow. If you cultivate loving kindness, your compassion will grow. If you cultivate compassion, your wisdom will grow. That's the nice thing about it. It's a system that's connected. But you can also specifically focus on compassion. And so if the proximate cause of feeling friendly is seeing the goodness in someone, What would be the proximate cause of feeling compassion? Be seeing their pain, right? Their suffering. Or our own pain, or our own suffering. So a lot of our meditation, our mindfulness meditation on the cushion and certainly on retreats, is becoming more and more aware of our own suffering. And then that connects us to more compassion for ourselves and also compassion for others. You know, particularly when you go on retreats, if you've been on a few retreats, then you see certain other people struggling and you remember a retreat where you had that particular struggle. Or you can feel, you know, when you've never been on a retreat, maybe the first time the person next to you has a terrible cold and they're coughing and they're sneezing. And at first you feel irritated. But later, as you've done more practice and more retreats, you just have huge compassion because it's happened to you. You know how hard it is to hang in there in a retreat when you're just, you know, the whole system is mucus everywhere and so forth. So that sort of thing, we see our own suffering. We feel compassion for ourselves. We see suffering in others and we feel compassion. It is the proximate cause. I'd like to read you one of my favorite poems on this particular point, really. It's by Naomi Shihab Nye, a Native American. It's called Kindness. Before you know what kindness really is, you must lose things. Feel the future dissolve in a moment like salt in a weakened broth. What you held in your hand, what you counted and carefully saved, all this must go, so you know how desolate the landscape can be between the regions of kindness. How you ride and ride, thinking the bus will never stop. The passengers eating maize and chicken will stare out of the window forever. Before you learn the tender gravity of kindness, you must travel where the Indian in a white poncho lies dead beside the road. You must see how this could be you. How he too was someone who journeyed through the night with plans and the simple breath that kept him alive. Before you know kindness as the deepest thing inside, you must know sorrow as the other deepest thing. You must wake up with sorrow. You must speak to it till your voice catches the thread of all sorrows and you see the size of the cloth. Then it is only kindness that makes sense anymore. Only kindness that ties your shoes and sends you out into the day to mail letters and purchase bread. Only kindness that raises its head from the crowd of the world to say, "It is you I have been looking for." And it goes with you everywhere, like a shadow or a friend. So that sense of contracting and then letting go can also be letting go into compassion, letting go into kindness, letting go into forgiveness. Just forgive it. Stephen Levine says, have mercy. Have mercy. The wonderful thing is this opening to wisdom, big mind, luminous emptiness, primordial awareness, compassion, kindness. In that process, we join with this enormous energy, this ocean of wisdom and compassion. So instead of struggling, pretending that we're this separate drop that has to do all its work by itself and keep control of everything and run a tight ship and survive the storm alone or with just a few, we can open to this vastness, realizing that all that separation was an illusion, and that we are actually carried in like waves on the ocean, like sunlight in the sky, with a vast connection with many, 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 many immeasurable beings. Even in our suffering, even in our difficulty, we can connect with the ocean of beings. The Tonglen practices teach very specific ways of doing that, but one very, very easy way is whatever it is, whatever your suffering is right now, maybe you're bored, maybe you're confused, maybe you have a backache, whatever it is, we can breathe in and feel that total confusion. I don't know what I'm doing. And then as we breathe out, sending loving kindness and compassion to all beings who are feeling that same difficulty. In that moment, we have both transformed our suffering or our difficulty into part of the path, and we have connected with a gigantic sangha. And particularly now that the population of this planet is so huge, you can pretty much be guaranteed whatever your problem is, difficulty, suffering, distress, it's going to be 100,000, 200,000, 300,000 other beings on the planet right now in this moment feeling lonely, feeling, you know, the aching of the body at aging, feeling restless, feeling anxiety, whatever it is. And so as we exhale and connect with them, there's a sense of lack of loneliness, a sense of connection. It's this wonderful feeling of being part of an enormous sangha of what we would call the suffering sentient beings. But then as we lean on each other and feel that connectedness, we also learn how to let go of the suffering, the narrowing. When you realize that on the planet somewhere, there is more than one person right now radiating loving kindness to all beings everywhere. And since you are part of that group, you are being sent loving kindness right now from many parts of the globe, from many very holy beings. There are beings on retreat who do it 24/7, as they say, directing loving kindness to everyone on the planet. So we can just breathe that in right now with a sense of gratitude and joy. There are others who care about us. They may not have even met us, but that doesn't matter. When they meet us, they'll meet us with joy because that's what they do. That's who they are. And that's what we're learning to become as well on our path. Another lovely poem and then one verse from the Buddha. But first, I know there are great Mary Oliver fans here. The Buddha's last instruction, make of yourself a light, the Buddha said before he died. I think of this every morning as the east begins to tear off its many clouds of darkness. To send up the first signal, a white fan streaked with pink and violet, even green. An old man, he lay down between two solid trees, and he might have said anything, knowing it was his final hour. The light burns upward. It thickens and settles over the fields. Around him, the villagers gathered and stretched forward to listen. Even before the sun itself hangs disattached in the blue air, I am touched everywhere by its ocean of yellow waves. No doubt he thought of everything that had happened in his difficult life. And then I feel the sun itself as it blazes over the hills like a million flowers on fire. Clearly I'm not needed, yet I feel myself turning into something of inexplicable value. Slowly, beneath the branches, he raised his head. He looked into the faces of that frightened crowd. And though that's the end of the poem, I always like to go to the beginning again and say, make of yourself a light. I realize I didn't leave any room for questions. There's always something, isn't there? Oh, well, I'm going to leave you with this verse, and then maybe we'll have, if anybody's got a burning question. May all beings everywhere, seen and unseen, dwelling far off or nearby, being or waiting to become, may all be filled with lasting joy. The Buddha, our teacher. Thank you.